Here we go.
10:06, Bucky's Auto Service Center. Say it with me, Tom. Big exploding B. Bucky's Auto Service Center, right? For 48 years. Don't rush them. How did you feel when you turned 50? Was it a big deal? They make a big party of it? And you're like, oh, here I go. I'm almost dead.
Yep.
All right.
You know what I did for my 50th?
I'm sorry, I was underwater. What'd you say?
My 50th birthday party. Yeah. We had a party. I had everybody come by. And
at Bucky's?
And I asked them to bring their favorite book as a gift to me. So I got a collection of all my friends' favorite books.
Love that.
You do.
That is really cool. Well, good job. Well, I don't know what they're going to do for Bucky's big 50th, but right now they're celebrating 40 years. Bucky's Auto Service Center, 13 locations. Take your car there. And by the way, bring your favorite book in, because they like that. When you bring your book in. Give it to the mechanic.
Books at Bucky's. I like the ring.
What is it? The Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance?
Yeah.
Yes, yeah, there
you bet.
Get halfway through that, and I think, what the hell is this thing about? All right, here we go. Could Seattle housing prices come down? Zillow predicts a recession by 2020.
Okay. Now, to be fair to Zillow, this is a survey of a bunch of economic experts, and 50% of them, about half of them, predicted that the recession would happen by 2020.
Don't poop on the story yet until I play some sound.
I'm not pooping on it. I'm trying to just contextualize it.
Yeah. Here we go. Matthew Gardner, of the chief economist for Windermere, is predicting a recession is coming by the end of 2019.
The biggest thing, I think, is going to be geopolitical. I think trade wars, no one wins a trade war.
Yeah.
I think the posturing we're doing, certainly with President Xi right now, is not positive. That is likely to be, well, it's quite possible that could be one of the consequences or one of the reasons why it will happen. Additionally, Fed tightening. I think the Federal Reserve is looking to an economy which is getting a bit bubbly. And if they start raising interest rates too quickly, that is something else which could push us into a recession.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what he's trying to do is he's trying to give you the triggers. What would be the trigger? The Zillow people thought the geopolitical event was lower down on the on the scale than he does. But the idea is that just about everybody thinks it's going to happen either in the end of 2019, so in the end, a little over a year from now, or in 2020, and some in 2021. But it's like there's no doubt since everything seems to be cyclical, there's going to be some kind of recession.
Right.
I guess the size of the recession is what's in doubt.
It's the length of growth. So 120 months is the most, I think, the 120-month boom was back in the 1990s. So I think we're at 100 months now of economic growth. And the question is, whatever goes up must come down. So there's three factors, they say. One is the Fed decides to put the brakes on, because they don't want it to grow too fast, because then you get inflation.
Right.
So they put the brakes on. They've got two pedals. One is make cash more available and cheaper, and they flood the market with cheap cash for capital for people to invest. Or the other one is put the brake on it, stop that by raising the rates so that you don't have too much going. If they start it too soon, it sends an indicator that things are not good or cash becomes too expensive, and then you start to see business begin to cut back. They cut back, they lay people off, people laid off, and it's the great thing that a friend of mine from Wells Fargo told me in 2008 or 9. He said to me, he goes, 90% of the people, 10% are unemployed. 90% are acting like they're about to be unemployed. And once that happens, he goes, then you get the tightening of the credit, the interest rates go up, and then there's this mentality that things are really bad. But consumer confidence right now, thank you, Donald Trump, is as high as it's been since what year, Tom?
Probably since right before
since
the
2000.
Recession.
Since 2000. This is the highest it has been since 2000, where people just really feel like, hey, good times are here to come.
But they're not. See, that's what's interesting. It's like just when we feel like, we're on this big wave. The nice thing is we're not going to have it. They don't expect, at least these experts, another housing crash that caused the Great Recession of 2008-2009. In fact,
could it be good news for renters?
We're bringing on way too many apartment units. And so we went from a supply-demand balance to actually now we're going to be oversupplied. But as we bring on a lot more units, then we'll start seeing some rent compression occurring. And rent certainly will stop going up, and they are quite likely to drop.
Oh, what do you know? Supply and demand. So if the city would allow more building, you would actually have more apartments, and you have the rent come down.
No, but that's what he's saying, though. We're building too many. See, that's the first time I've heard anybody say that we have too many apartments now on the cusp, because we're adding, something like 7,000 new apartments or something. And he says that may be too much. The significant thing about, I heard this interview on Seattle's Morning News says, this is not going to be anything like that last recession.
Well, that's what he said. Hold
okay,
on.
Okay, do we have
nothing
that
like
even
it.
Better?
It really would. I mean, the 08, 09 recession was essentially the second worst in modern history.
Yeah.
So I think, my opinion, it's going to look a lot like the 1991 recession. It's going to be fairly slim. Unemployment rate will not rise above 6.5% in the last two quarters, and then we'll carry on again. So it'll be nothing like it, and certainly it will not be driven by housing.
Yeah, that's the thing. You could see, it's pretty simple. I don't know why people didn't see it. I didn't see it coming. So people that couldn't afford a house, the government gave them a loan, and then the government backed all these loans, and then they were on adjustable rate mortgages, which would adjust within 3 years, which means they paid like 0% or hardly any percent. But within 3 years, it would adjust to 2% above the prime or wherever they're supposed to go to. And then all of a sudden, they didn't have the money for it. So easily, you could see the entire group of people that all of a sudden got housing drop out. The bottom fell out of the thing. And then you got all the other stuff that went with it. But people should have seen that coming, right? And when the adjustable rate mortgages adjust, you lose that entire layer of people that were unable to afford the homes.
Yeah, and there are a lot of The Big Short. There's a great movie about it. There are books about this. And the thing is that in retrospect, it makes perfect sense.
Yes.
But at the time, all the experts, there was like one guy who was saying, hey, wait, you know, banging pots and pans. This can't, sir, and no one listened to him because we were so caught up in the real estate speculation. And that just cratered the economy. Not going to happen next time.
Wait, Andrew has something he'd like to say.
Quick note on the 1991 recession.
Yes.
The New York Times cites that as one of the top reasons that Bill Clinton won his election, his first election.
That's right.
And it hurt Bush. So
that's right. When I remember, because I talked to the president, hate to be a name dropper, Tom. But
yes, which president?
Bush.
Bush,
when
okay.
The recession ended in March, and most of the major newspapers kept referring to the recession. And I said to him, I said, you know what? Everybody keeps calling the recession. It's over. It ended in March. He goes, I know it ended in March. He goes, why don't you get the word out? I said, I'm just a weatherman. What the hell am I going to do? All right. Even though rents in Seattle.
I can't even predict the weather properly.
It doesn't matter. Who cares? My hair looked good. But even though the rents, I did spend, again, it's not going to come as a shock to anyone. I spent more time on my hair than I did my naps.
Yeah, no, I'm sure.
Okay, good.
I don't think they knew that when they hired you.
Even though the rents could be coming down in Seattle because of the way the city is zoned, we still can't build our way out of the need for housing. And when talent can't afford to live here, the jobs go away. Uh-oh.
I mean, my biggest concern really in our region in its entirety, housing prices. And at some point, think about it. If a company is going to be moving here, the most important thing they think about it, is there a talented workforce? Well, yeah, we're smart.
Yeah.
But secondly is, how much do I have to pay people? And the biggest component of salaries is cost of living. And so ultimately, at some point, companies will say, wow, you're too expensive. We don't want to become another San Francisco. Mm-mm. And that's what we're seeing right now, a flood of people coming up here from the Bay Area because our housing prices are cheap.
Compared to San Francisco.
Compared to San Francisco, yeah. Exactly. And so, but at what point did all of a sudden people say, no, Seattle's not good. Perhaps we'll start thinking about expanding in Boise, Idaho. Yeah. Perhaps we'll go to Spokane, Washington.
Or Tacoma.
or Tacoma.
No, he said Tacoma is too – this is interesting. He said Tacoma is too far south. People are willing to move to Spokane and Boise, but not to Tacoma. And he says, because he says, that's too far south. He says, maybe Bellevue, maybe Kirkland, but not all the way to Tacoma. And I figure, that doesn't sound right.
Having driven to Boise and having driven to Tacoma, I can tell you.
I take Tomcoma over Boise.
That is why that is. There's a prejudice against Tacoma that they won't go south.
I don't know what he said by. He didn't say prejudice. He says that, and he made it sound like Tacoma is just a little. It's nearby, but it's a little too far south.
Mm.
That if you're going to stay in the area, you're more apt to go east.
Yeah.
To the east side, not to Bellevue and Kirkland something. I don't know that.
The simple equation to look at is, okay, say housing prices continue to rise at 10%. Let's say 10%. 10% a year. I think it's 17 was the last one. Is your income going up 10% a year? Your income's not going up. Eventually, somebody's income comes in and gets it, but their income will not go up 10%. So as the house continues to grow in cost and your job doesn't keep track with it, you end up having this big gap. Who's in there to fill this thing?
Yes. And so I'm not quite sure what he thinks the resolution is. If we get too expensive for the people that are moving in, if they move out, will that then help deflate the market in such a way that the more middle class people can afford to move back in? Or at that point, it's already the level has been set.
Yeah.
Because San Francisco, I mean, we are we're the cheaper alternative to San Francisco, but San Francisco is not exactly hurting for, you know,
but
for
then,
people.
Right, but it only takes a few other businesses to realize, oh, there's a cheaper alternative to Seattle, and it's wherever it is, and then you set up a couple there, and then that becomes the hot place.
Yes, it becomes a hot place, but does Seattle, here's what I don't understand. If all of a sudden Boise, Idaho becomes the hot place, does Seattle's economy crater, or does it say, like San Francisco, a lot of people have left the Bay Area to come up to Seattle because it's cheaper. Well, San Francisco didn't crater. Its economy didn't crater either, so I don't know if Seattle's always going to be now this kind of high-end city by comparison, or if it will, you know, revert to its more middle-class ways.
Well, what causes the cost to go up is the competition for the individual that has the brains to do the job. So one company offers X and the other company offers X plus something to get that guy to come over to them, right? So now if you get another company sets up or a bunch of companies set up somewhere in Boise and they start to drain brain these people out of Seattle, right? So now we don't have that dynamic, we have the infrastructure, but we don't have the dynamic, you know, capital flow through Seattle. So then things sort of settle back down, and you don't have enormous growth of 10 or 17% on the housing. It's just bumping along at 3 or 4% like other cities across the eastern seaboard.
Yeah. See, I just don't know if that can happen.
All right.
I don't know if it will, and I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing that it won't.
I can tell you this. When it comes to Donald Trump, President Trump's tweets, there's a piece that was just in the Washington Post had this one.
Boston Globe.
Oh, boy. They say that a lot of these tweets, the ones that come out early in the morning are the president's, but the staff has written posts, and then there's other people that are involved in it. And the bad grammar is apparently on purpose, mm-hmm. and they often delight in the chaos that's created by these tweets.
Yeah, this is a pretty clever. First off, there's a guy at The Atlantic who came up with an algorithm to determine if the president had really tweeted it out or somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And he admits now, two years into his presidency, that his staff is getting much better. That it's getting trickier, harder and harder to distinguish between who the president, that the staff is, as staffs always do, they try to write speeches mm-hmm. to mimic the cadence of the president they're working for. And in this case, since he lives so much on Twitter, they try to mimic his tweets. And they say, yes, that they do. Now, they said, we never try to misspell. These are two inside sources. Mm-hmm. The misspellings are, you know, mistakes, and they're not proud of that. But they say they try to do things that grammatically attract people's attention and have this wacky sense of capitalization that makes no sense. Because he says, because it sets the, as they call them, the elites, mm-hmm. it makes them go crazy, and they love that. They say they win anytime somebody on the air goes, oh my God, grammatically this or grammatically that.
Right.
Because more people are grammatic, dumbbells uh-huh. than not. And so they go, yes, he's a man of the people. That they're using the tweets and the mistakes in the tweets to identify with the great mass of people who also are full of, tweet typos.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, it's seen as, even in his tweets, they're seen as kind of outreaches to his people, his base, and people that like him.
So they have two messages.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They work on many levels, John. In fact, they rarely work on the level of logic or sense. They really are more after, let's get attention to whatever. That's what, like, he's perfectly manipulating things today. Now he's even, there was no spy, but now he's called it Spygate and claiming Spygate is the biggest thing since Watergate or something like that. The idea
the tweet
is that,
Tom, Spygate, that's all capitalized.
Yeah. Okay.
Could be one of the biggest political scandals in history.
Right.
All right.
He had one that he says, it's the biggest witch hunt since Watergate. And somebody pointed out, the thing is, there was a witch in Watergate. It was the president himself. So, but anyway, and they say they do things intentionally vague.
Mm-hmm.
And is there a danger about that? It's not a political danger, but there is, they say, a constitutional danger, because now you realize that you're getting used to a president who never can be pinned down. And if it's vague language, you can go back and forth and
back
and forth.
So are you saying that they do this to tweak the media?
Well, not the media. Well, yeah, I mean, the media to some degree. But, I mean, the idea is that to tweet the people that would get upset
liberals.
By bad grammar. Well, not liberals, because there are a lot of liberals that aren't very good grammatically. I mean, I taught grammar. Believe me, the conservatives and the liberals are, equally bad. No, it's this idea that they say it's a class thing. It's an elitist thing. If you really care about grammar, oh, you're one of those.
Oh,
you think
I
you're
see.
Better
okay.
than everybody else.
Okay. The NFL has got an announcement. They say new policy requires on-field players and personnel to stand for the anthem. They're not going to fine the individuals. They would fine one of the 32 owners would fine themselves, or the club or league would fine the team.
That's right. So this has been, they took 3 hours yesterday and they had a wrap-up session today. And initially, yesterday, they said they might penalize a team 15 yards. They'll actually have in-game penalties for anybody who's doing this.
Mm-hmm.
They decided to abandon that, and they came up with what they consider a compromise. I heard John Clayton yesterday on 710 ESPN say the compromise should be go back to the way it was in 2008 and before, which is they never were out there for the national anthem. This never was an issue. It's when the military paid the NFL to have these military displays that they said, okay, and then we'll bring out all the players. That's what caused the problem. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the suggestions. They didn't take that either. Their compromise is that you are going to be fined if your player comes out and kneels and or sits during the national anthem because it looks disrespectful. However, the player or any players have the right to stay in the locker room and not come out until the national anthem is over.
Bad move.
That's the compromise. Okay, so why do you think it's a bad move?
Because it's divisive. You're supposed to
of
be a team, and everybody wears a uniform so that everybody is on the same team, right? So the idea is, like, if you're going to give some the option, let's say, God forbid, there's another shooting, right?
Mm-hmm.
Another person gets shot and killed by a police officer, making it, like, 8 unarmed black men killed in 2018 by a cop. So let's say that happens, and it happens in October. Well, now the guys are all sitting in the locker room. Are you going out? You're going to go, you're going out there. You're going to go out there. And then now immediately we have created conflict before the game. I can't believe you went out there. Well, don't give me a hard time. I'm here to practice. I'm here to play football. You know what? Well, maybe some things are bigger than football. So then this whole conversation starts when really you're supposed to be playing football.
Okay.
So keep everybody in the locker room. You don't need them out there for the camera to span across their faces as they
rock back and forth with
their hands holding onto their shoulder pads. By the way, that would have been my look if I were playing professional football. I'd do the hands locked into the shoulder pad look. I like that. Yeah.
Well, no, the reason
keep them in the locker room.
So, and the thing is that there were some of the owners that thought that was too
you're giving over to the players.
Yeah, giving into the players, like by reverting to the way they had. So they didn't want to do this. So this was the compromise they came up with. By the way, you said that individual players would not be fined. They could be fined. They're leaving it up to the teams. So the NFL has a policy. No player who is visible during the national anthem is allowed to kneel or sit, as long as he's not visible. But if a team decides, I wouldn't be surprised if Jerry Jones with the Dallas Cowboys says, if you're a Dallas Cowboy, you're out on the field and you're standing at attention, and leave it at that.
Mm.
The teams can individually fine. Say Michael Bennett was on our team this year, and he decided not to come out and stay in the locker room. It would be up to the teams. They said, you know, that hurts team morale. I can't imagine Pete Carroll doing that, but I can't imagine Jerry Jones and Bob McNair of the Houston Texans doing that.
I got one more idea just off the top of my head, somewhat half-baked. How about the sidelines, razor-sharp spikes so you can't kneel? All on the sidelines.
That's good. What if you're allowed to wear a little, a little flag on your...
I'm going back to my razor-sharp spikes along the sideline. All right, let's see. Come back and tell Andrew found this story. If you're rich, you're more lucky than smart.
Says a poor guy to a rich guy.
There's math to prove it. Oh, boy. We'll come right back. The Tom and Curly Show. Hey, rich people, stay with us. We're about to beat you up.
My girl.
Thank you.
I wish I knew the words.
We karaoke, you know, the bump music. What's going in there, Andrew? What are you doing, huh?
I just like the song.
These weren't your special requests?
No.
You still haven't caught on to that? Like, tell him what you want.
That's not fair. He has his own thing going on in there. All right. Like Dory. You're number one. You don't need to follow number two.
Oh, goodness.
Boom! You can write to us at mynorthwest.com. You can text as well at 98973.
Ursula thought you were her girl.
Yes.
My girl.
My boy.
Okay, Ursula, thank you. Where is that cut, that drop of you talking about being hydrated? Okay, we'll find it. Tom, here's the headline. If you are rich... You are more likely to be lucky than smart.
You're more lucky than smart. Not right. saying you're not smart.
I know, because what they did is they said, so they took the top, what they say, three people in the world have a certain percentage of all the wealth, and then everybody else doesn't have what they have.
That's
so
right.
then they say, so then, and if all qualities are sort of equally distributed, you can have really smart people that really, are not rich, and then you can have really dumb people that might have some money. So they try to figure out, what are the qualities? You apparently need three qualities in order to be super rich or better than most, and one of them happens to be luck.
Yeah, so it's a really cleverly written piece on PBS NewsHour that cites a study. So we're not looking at the actual mathematical breakdown of the study, but it is a they claim that there's a mathematical principle behind this. But he starts off by saying that he's covered business as a journalist for 40 years, and so he knows the people that are good at business, mm-hmm. you know, the successful business and others, and he realized that after spending that much time, and it's remarkable how many at the top were unremarkable, that why this businessman is successful and this businessman isn't is it seems there's a degree of arbitrariness that we don't normally acknowledge.
Okay.
We normally point to things like personal qualities or brains or hard work or ingenuity or cleverness, all these kinds of things, social connections. But he says that you cannot that does not work to explain how the richest people get rich without acknowledging the role of luck.
Mm-hmm.
That you could be equal in all sorts of matters. But where he really gets it, you went right to the essence of it, which is if we assume that things like talent and brains and ingenuity and hard work and effort and all these kinds of things, they tend to be distributed on an even mm-hmm. basis across all of humanity.
Right. Just to put it in perspective, he says there's one Jack the Ripper, there's one Mother Teresa, and most of us are in the middle.
We're in the middle,
okay.
Yes.
All right.
And so you have this kind of it's kind of like this classic kind of a bell curve kind of a thing. And he says, but the one weird thing is, and that's true across the board, but the one weird thing about this is that when it comes to wealth,
mm-hmm.
they don't have that normal distribution. And he says it's called a power law, that's sometimes also called the 80-20 rule.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that there's that 80%, 20% distribution? There's not a natural distribution. And when you work out all the factors, the factor that is not included in any of these is the idea of luck.
Mm-hmm.
So you could have two equally brilliant, equally hardworking, equally whatever people, and one will be successful and one won't, and it's the role of luck. Now there's a lot of leeway in terms of what you consider luck, but what he's saying is that's the one factor that can explain something like a power rule.
Does it take anything away from the success of the individual that has earned it?
Here's what it does. What it does is it kind of minimizes it to the point that if you're the eighth richest men in the world, mm-hmm. you know, have equal
that wealth of a billion,
$3 billion or something like that. And so that kind of extreme stuff is out of whack. And so what it means is that there are other people that are equally as talented or work as hard or just as this or that, that aren't as rich. So if Bill Gates looked at somebody who, you know, I don't know who else he could look at, maybe Steve Jobs, if Bill Gates beat out Steve Jobs in that head-to-head competition, well, is Bill Gates any better than Steve Jobs?
Mm-hmm.
Some argue just the opposite, but the idea is there is a kind of luck involved for these people. They had to be in the right place at the right time, who you knew, these kinds of things. That's the luck factor.
So Malcolm Gladwell has an entire book about people that had succeeded. And it tells a story about a sociologist that was sitting, this is at a Canadian hockey tournament, and these are the best of the best of the best of the high school players.
Yeah.
And his nephew or something's out there on the ice. And he happens to be looking at the program. And he's looking at the program, and he turns to his wife, he goes, wow, look at this. What do you see that all these players have in common? And it showed the kid's name, his age, where he was from. These are the best of the best out of Canada.
Yeah.
And their birth date.
Yeah.
And he said their birth date falls within January 13th to February 7th. Every single kid on the ice was within the confines of those dates.
Uh-huh.
So he decides, you know what? I'm going to look into this. I want to find out why. This is in Malcolm Gladwell's book.
Yeah.
So he says what he finds out is that they were the oldest kid on the ice compared to all the other kids by what day practice started. Like, by the way, we want everybody out on the ice February 1st or whatever, right? And he said what happens is the older kid the bigger kid got more attention from the coach than the other kids, the younger kids and smaller kids. More one-on-one attention. They got more accolades. And because where their birthday was and when ice hockey practice started, they are then, therefore, ahead of everybody else.
Yeah.
So just, there you go.
The
there's
luck
pure
of
luck.
Your birth
Absolute
phase,
luck.
Yes.
And then every once in a while, there's like a weird sort of anomaly that falls in there. Shaquille O'Neal's dad, guess how tall he is?
I assume not as tall as he is.
6'1".
No.
Yes, but Shaquille O'Neal at the age of 16 was 6'7" tall.
Yeah.
And then eventually he sprung up to 7'1" or something like that, weigh more than 300 pounds. But his dad was a tiny guy.
Yeah.
His mom wasn't much bigger either, but that's just a weird analogy. And then the other one he pointed to was Bill Gates. So he said Bill Gates, he went to Lakeside, and his mom encouraged him to get into programming and stuff. Not far from where Bill Gates lived, the University of Washington had a computer programming lab that was open 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
And so at 2:30 in the morning or 1:30 in the morning, the young Bill Gates would go down there and work on programming. Now, no one else his age had that thing. Because the Gates' proximity to where their house was, the University of Washington, the connections that they had, young Bill Gates could get in there and do programming. Mm-hmm. Therefore, he was far ahead of everyone else. And when the internet took off, there you have someone like Bill Gates, leading the way.
So this is not to discount that if you're successful, that you didn't, play, hard work or talent or intelligence didn't play a role. It's just that you also have to acknowledge that luck also, plays a significant role in some of these kinds of things, too. One of the things that happens is once you're successful, then you look around and go, well, of course, cream rises to the top. Of course I would be successful.
I did all the right things.
Because I'm a good guy and I'm smart and I try all these kinds of things. And he said, yeah, but there are also people in your identical situation that didn't have whatever lucky break you had.
Mm-hmm.
I think of it, it's easier to understand, I think, when you think of actors. I think there are so many great actors in the world. And yet, if you're not in the right place at the right time or get cast through all sorts of, lucky breaks, there may be great actors you'll never hear of, and the ones that rise to the top aren't good either. It's not that they're not good, but there may be other equally good actors that didn't get that chance.
And a lot of it is who you know.
Yeah, that's what
a
they
lot
say.
Of it's who you know, right?
It's connections.
Yeah. Let's see. You think you always say thank you? Apparently we don't.
We apparently think we do more often than we do.
But Tom points out where people say thank you in one of the oddest places.
Yes.
You would never expect this person to thank this other person. We'll be right back. Time is flying by, and then I realize I got to stick around and do Ron and Dance. Just like, out of here at noon. It's beautiful out there.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
Oh, my. Stories coming up. We'll talk about the epic Supreme Court decision on employment. If you heard a little bit of it and you're like, I don't understand how that all works, we'll sort that out for you, what they determined yesterday regarding employees having the ability to sue. Plus, the shortage of truck drivers causing prices to rise. That might be a job that you might want to look into. And then finally, we get to the part that people are not as grateful as they think they are. When I asked in a survey, are you grateful? People say, yeah, I'm a grateful individual. And one way of expressing gratitude is by doing what, Tom?
Saying thank you.
Uh-huh.
And apparently we all think that we're more grateful than we are, and we also think we say thank you more often than we are. And so they've done this big study, and it's a cross-cultural study from all around the world. And it turns out that we say, they say that expressions of gratitude in general, saying something like thank you, happens only in 1 in 20 occasions.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's not very much. However, the guy who's doing this study, a linguist at the University of Sydney, said, this is good news, actually. Why is it good news that we don't thank people? Because it means that we are getting what we want and it's expected. He says, when we ask people to help us, the default is that they will. And they say that it's true that in our culture, if I ask you, hey, could you help me, with my chair? Could you help me do this or that? The expectation is that you will.
Okay.
And if we have a societal expectation that when Tom asks John to help him, John helps Tom, then we don't feel the need to say thank you. It would be nice, but the idea is that because you would expect the same thing. If I ask you, can I borrow your pen? Do you expect me to thank you for borrowing your pen? No, it's just, well, yeah, here. I mean, Ursula's always going, hey, can I use your pen? It's seen as so obviously I would do that, that it doesn't rise to the level of needing a thank you. And that shows a good society, that we, the expectation is that we will help somebody. Now, right. obviously, it's within reason. If you ask somebody to, can you help me move on Friday or Saturday or something, if it's a big expectation, but the idea is that usually we say thank you, we think of thank yous only with big things, but in general things, we help people all the time. And he said, so that's a good sign. That seven times more often do you help me when I ask you than not. And so he says that's a sign of social cohesion, and so it's okay if we don't say thank you all the time.
So I went down and bought an egg sandwich down the street and just about 2 hours ago. And the lady handed it to me. I said, thank you. Am I not supposed to say thank you?
No. It's fine. It's good. He's not saying that it's bad to say thank you. It's just that it's not an indication of social decline if people don't say thank you.
Okay.
But, yeah, so one of the things that I noticed, and this is a thing, so Jim Page is a longtime, you know, folk singer around town, and he's, you know, he's been around for like 40 years. I remember when he was back on the UW campus, you know, protesting things. He had a song. I went and saw a concert of his, and he had a song about the Metro bus. That's hilarious that he took that. But it was about the phenomenon of everybody who gets off the bus thanks the bus driver. And I hadn't even noticed that, even though I've been riding all this. And it is true. I noticed in the morning, people get off the bus and say thank you to the driver. It's his job. We're paying him. It's very a menial task, in effect. It's not like, you know, there's any kind of interaction. It's just something that he does.
But what would be a better thing to say?
No. I think it's great. What I liked about it is I think that is really great that we're in a situation that we thank the bus driver for, you know, driving us safely down, even though it's something he's expected to. And that was one of those instances when we say thank you a lot, I would think.
Yeah.
But this idea, so that's why I thought this story would be interesting. Oh, we don't say thank you enough. Well, we certainly do on the bus. Now it turns out, even if we didn't do it on the bus, it would be okay because we expect him to return the favor when we pay, you know, his
Some of the oddest times to say thank you is when a police officer gives you a speeding ticket.
Oh, yeah.
He hands it through the window. It's an odd thing. You just go, thank you.
Thanks.
Hey, $136.
By the way, and they do say in some cultures,
yes.
If you thank you, they say in some South Asian languages, to say thank you is seen as an insult.
Mm.
So I don't know if that's the expectation. Well, of course, don't thank me for something that I would, do of my own accord anyway or something. Mm-hmm. So there are cultural differences. But in general, it just makes us feel good about our society, even if it doesn't seem quite as polite.
I thought I would have sort of for my auction business. Thought it'd be clever to learn how to say thank you in like 10 different languages.
Oh yeah, okay.
Chokran is how you say it in Moroccan.
Okay.
Vanaka naka levu is Fijian. But the problem is that like people are like, huh?
Yeah.
And then you don't have time to like explain. By the way, that's Moroccan for thank you.
You need to have Moroccans and Fijians in the audience to
that's
appreciate.
That's my problem. I don't have enough. All right, coming back. Top of the hour for you. The Dow Constantine wants to buy 65,000 acres with your money. And could that also cause us to have a problem when it comes to housing? Plus, there's a new device that you could possibly see at a concert. That was invented. Was this a local kid?
Yes. You won a contest.
Hopefully this thing takes off. And also, why you should stop being so hard on yourself. And learn something brand new. You can do it in not 10,000 hours, but a shorter amount of time. And also, I have a confession to make about a cat on the side of a highway today, Tom. And I'm going to need some support from you.
Okay. I'll be there for you, John.
Right,
we'll
back.
Tear up together.
Okay.